It's been a couple days since I've had a full-blown meltdown. That's Pup the Band. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. A full-blown meltdown for the Toronto Blue Jays bullpen last night. It cost them a sweep. It cost them a chance to, I mean, it's very, very early to look at the American League East standings, but they're back into a three-way tie for the bottom of that division. They blew one against the Yankees, and it's a tough one because anytime it's the bullpen that blows it, well, we get to do the best thing, the thing that sports radio exists for, which is pick apart the manager's decisions in utilizing that bullpen. Before we get into that, this is Jays Talk Plus. We are back for the season, 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. on the Sportsnet Radio Network, Sportsnet 360, Sportsnet Plus. We'll eventually be back to 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., which is our normal time slot from the last two summers, but that will wait until the Toronto Maple Leafs are done in the playoffs. You can get a lot of Toronto Maple Leafs content the rest of the day, the Jeff Merrick Show, Kipper and Bourne, etc. We'll be here for 1 hour for now. Today, on the first, I guess, official episode back, we've done a bunch of them already, but we have Dan Schulman joining us in a few minutes here. We're just waiting to get Dan on the line. We'll also be joined by Ben Clemens of Fangraphs, one of my favorite people to talk to, one of our show's regulars. So while we wait for Dan Schulman to join us, let's go through last night's game. It's a 6-4 loss to the New York Yankees. The story of it is, of course, the bullpen. Before we get to that point, though, Kevin Gausman looks back. He has a rough first inning, dances around trouble, gets the pitch count up. The New York Yankees, historically, over Gausman's time as a Blue Jay, among teams that have seen him more than once, only the Minnesota Twins swing at Gausman's pitches less frequently. Now, we've heard theories in the past that the Twins have something on Gausman. It's helped them lay off the splitters low and, you know, stick to the fastballs that come more in the zone. Maybe that's something the Yankees are doing as well. The Yankees are also just generally a pretty disciplined team. They have players who are pretty good at laying off pitches, are willing to work late in counts. Juan Soto, obviously the current king of base on balls. So Gausman struggled a little bit early. The velocity was there at least, which is very, very nice. It touched as high as 97.9. It averaged just shy of 95. He also ended up throwing 101 pitches. So if you're wondering, hey, is Gausman, you know, back fully ramped up after the abbreviated spring training? It certainly looks like he is. So after that first inning where he danced around trouble a little bit, it's all good from there. One earned run over five innings, strikes out six, gets 14 swing and miss. And again, this is a Yankees team that isn't swinging at a ton of these pitches. So Gausman did a good job elevating the splitter back up into the bottom part of the zone to steal some strikes and making sure he was mixing that fastball and splitter effectively so that the Yankees couldn't sit off of it entirely. 14 whiffs, pretty good number given how infrequently the Yankees swing at Gausman's stuff. So things are looking good. The Blue Jays also got two home runs from Dalton Varsho. Both of those home runs were pulled to right field, which is great to see. Dalton Varsho got off to a pretty cold start to the season here. Obviously brings up some concerns after the down offensive year he had last season. But four home runs on this homestand, including two yesterday. Pretty encouraging stuff. You know, on the season, the on-base percentage is still below 300. But when you have four home runs in the first 19 games or so here, you're on a pretty good track from a power hitting perspective. And of course, he brings a ton of defensive value as well. So Varsho's two home runs help put the Jays ahead 4-1. They get to the bullpen portion. Rather, they're up 2-1. One of the home runs was insurance run after that. But they go to the bullpen. Trevor Richards gives him an inning. He'd thrown 26 pitches the day before. Was a little surprised to see him, especially in a spot where maybe you'd ask him to get two innings if he were fresher. He does his job. They turn it to Henesy Cabrera. They ask him to get them two innings. That mostly goes smooth. Juan Soto gets him for a home run despite the lefty-lefty matchup. Shocker, Juan Soto, very good no matter what hand the pitcher throws with. So that's an encouraging outing from Henesy Cabrera. He did give up a home run, which chipped into the lead a little bit, but you get one earned over two innings out of a middle relief guy that eats up a part of the tough part of the Yankees' order. You will live with that. Then in the ninth inning, the Jays now lead 4-2. They turn it to Eric Swanson. Eric Swanson hasn't pitched yet this year. He got a couple rehab appearances in. This is his first game back. You're using him in super high leverage here. Obviously, a two-run lead, division opponent. You're facing, 5-6-7 of the order, which is Giancarlo Stanton, Gleyber Torres, Alex Verdugo. You know, it's not Soto and Judge, but it's not the easiest chunk of the order. And the bet here is that, hey, if Eric Swanson's off the IL, which he is, and he's available to the Blue Jays, which he is, he's got to be able to pitch and leverage. That's his role with the Toronto Blue Jays. That's where they're going to need him for most of the season. So they put him out there, and he just does not have it. Stanton homers immediately. Torres singles, Verdugo doubles to put runners on second and third with nobody out. Fortunately, gets a ground out from Cabrera, and then they turn it over to Tim Mayza. So before we get to the Tim Mayza part, using Swanson in that scenario, you could nitpick with it. Again, though, I would probably lean toward, if this guy is active and you're told medically he's good to go, he's available, yes, ideally you'd love to get him in a low leverage spot to get his feet under him, to get that those first reps of the official season in. But if Eric Swanson, a guy you used in a ton of leverage last year, is available to you, I don't have a huge problem with using him against 5-6-7 in the Yankees order with a two-run lead, especially given what we knew about the bullpen availability, which we'll get to in a second. So Tim Mayza comes in from there. This is a rough one because Tim Mayza has not had a good start to the season at all. You're thinking, you know, maybe this is an okay spot because it's Trevino coming in, it's Volpe, and then hopefully you're out of this by the time it rolls around to Soto. Trevino hits an RBI single instead. Volpe does pop out, but that means you've got to face Soto. Soto walks. Judge rips a two-run single down the left field line to put the Yankees ahead 6-4. So it doesn't work out. Mayza eventually gets out of it. Bad, bad day for the bullpen. No question around it. They give up 5 over 4 innings. 5 over 3, really, after Richards gets that clean sixth for them. So that's tough. After the game, John Schneider obviously gets asked about this. Some of the caveats that we are informed about. While Jordan Romano is fresh off the IL and pitched the day prior, so they didn't want to use him in back-to-back situations. You can get there. They had said when he came off the IL that it was possible he'd be using a back-to-back spot. But again, if you have Eric Swanson available, you know, if you're going to make the argument that Jordan Romano should be trusted in leverage on back-to-back nights right off the IL, it's the same argument that Eric Swanson should be trusted in leverage when he's fresh off the IL as well, probably. And Romano pitched in leverage the night before. So no Romano, no Yimi Garcia because he'd pitched 2 days in a row. He's probably the guy that you'd trust 3 days in a row if you had to do it with someone, but it's very early in the season. So that's a tougher one to do there. We also found out afterwards, the most curious one as they went on, was that Chad Green wasn't available, which we didn't find out until after the game. He's been dealing with a sore shoulder that made him unavailable the last couple of games. It'll be interesting to see how that one plays out, because if he eventually needs an IL stint, then you can go back to when Swanson and Romano got activated and nitpick, well, should Pearson have gone down? You know, should you have DFA'd Mitch White and potentially lost that player for depth if a guy was about to go on the IL? You could also nitpick a little bit, and you can't know this ahead of time, but if the plan was Romano pitches one day, Swanson pitches another, maybe you could have delayed the IL activation for one of those players by a day, kept Pearson around an extra day for an extra arm or something like that. Really, though, if you have no Romano, you have no Garcia, you have no Green, Swanson's your leverage guy. Now, at Mayza's point, the other option you would have had is Bowden Francis. And I saw some people take the nod to Tim Mayza over Bowden Francis as a vote of no confidence in Bowden Francis, perhaps. I think it probably has more to do with the fact that Yariel Rodriguez is scheduled to pitch on Friday. We know he's not going to go long into games. They want to keep Bowden Francis available as a long man there. I know asset management-wise, bullpen management-wise, it's maybe not the best thing to have one reliever who's tethered to another starter. It's basically like using two it's kind of like using two roster spots for one starter. But if it was effective as it was the other day, you're probably going to live with that. And maybe it's a shorter term thing. So again, there is lots to nitpick about here. John Schneider historically has not been the sharpest of bullpen managers in my estimation. But last night, given that we found out afterwards, no Green, no Romano, no Yimi Garcia, I don't know what else you do there. Eric Swanson, again, in leverage. He's a leverage guy for you. He's off the IL. You're told he's healthy. He just didn't have it. At a certain point, your leverage guy's got to make pitches. They're not going to be the first bullpen to blow a game this year. They're not going to be the last bullpen to blow a game this year. It does suck, though. As John Schneider said after the game, today's a sour taste. You have an off day, but you had a sweep right there against a really good team and didn't get it done. They finished the homestand 6-3. They moved to 10-9 overall. The AL East, shocker, it's only taken 19 games for the AL East to look like the AL East is going to look all season long, three teams tied for third, fourth, fifth, while the top two teams kind of, you know, establishing themselves as really good here out of the gate. So Jays 10-9, 6-3 homestand overall. It doesn't sound like we're going to get Dan Schulman, by the way, if you're wondering why I'm going so long discussing last night's game in detail before we get to Dan Schulman. I don't think we're going to get Dan. So a couple other updates for you, and then I'm going to go into some things that I was set to talk to Dan about that, you know, one of the really nice things, especially now that the Raptors season is done, the Raptors show is done, to get to go and be down at the park a bunch more. And Dan and I had a good chat before Tuesday's game on the field before the game. And we were watching Kevin Biggio take some reps at third base. And it raised an eyebrow because, hey, this hasn't happened yet this year. What's going on? And as it turns out, Kevin Biggio started at third base last night. David Schneider started at second base. It's the first time we've seen that alignment. And I wanted to ask Dan, you know, how much stock do you put into what guys are doing pregame? Because in this case, it turns out Kevin Biggio taking reps at third base was indicative of what was to come. Kevin Biggio is going to play at third base. We've also seen, though, Alejandro Kirk taking reps at first base recently. I don't think that that's something that they're going to use in a game. It is worth acknowledging here and appreciating that Kevin Biggio's defensive versatility really does open up a lot for this team in terms of lineup flexibility. He's played mostly at second base, but he can play either corner outfield. He could play at third. He could spot in at first base. You know, I know there have been some concerns about his defense at third because of the arm. The arm has measured a little bit better this year, at least over at second base. So that's encouraging. But really, when you have a guy who could plug in this many spots, really does open up a lot for you alignment-wise. Hey, we want to get David Schneider in the lineup, but we want Kiermaier and Varsho in there for defense. Or, hey, we want to get Vlad a day off his feet and Justin Turner's down today. We want Springer off of his feet, and we don't want to try David Schneider in right or move one of Kiermaier or Varsho over to right. It's a nice flexibility piece. It helps to obviously didn't get any hits in yesterday's game, but it helps too that Kevin Biggio is off to a very nice start offensively, hitting almost 300 and OPSing almost 800 in the early going here. Okay. So Varsho hit two home runs yesterday, both pulled in the air to right field. Maybe an oversimplification, but I do think that that's going to be something to watch. You know, he's hit four home runs on this homestand. One of the criticisms of him last year, you know, look, guys are going to go hot and cold. Varsho has a bit of a sellout approach of all or nothing. But the version of him that hit 27 home runs in Arizona was supposed to be a version of him that would look good in Toronto in the new Rogers Center dimensions. We didn't see that last year. He did hit 20 home runs, but overall his offensive output was pretty low. He's a guy that, to me, has looked a little more comfortable in there. He had one of the best spring trainings on the team. The eight stolen bases he led Major League Baseball with in spring training haven't translated yet, but it is nice to see that level of confidence, that ability to manage the inner part of the plate a little better, and, of course, the power. Again, pull it in the air is sometimes an oversimplification, but with Varsho's particular swing and the way the right field power alley is supposed to play to left-handed hitters in the new Rogers Center, so far, so good. This season, that looks sharp. A couple other updates from around the Blue Jays. Aurelius Martinez hit a absolute moonshot last night. He hit like a 460-foot grand slam, actually, for the Buffalo Bisons. Baseball America shouted him out today as well as someone who's off to a nice start and is worth monitoring. Thanks to Clint B on Twitter for passing along the little blurb. Hitting 296 with a 519 slugging over the first 14 games of the season. And that grand slam he hit, sorry, it was 470 feet, not 460 feet. My bad, Aurelvis. I apologize for trimming 10 feet off of it there. Pretty good stuff. Also down there, Paolo Espino is going to start for Buffalo today. He's going to continue to stretch out and stay stretched out as the next long man up in the bullpen. Alek Manoah scheduled to start at AAA on Friday as he continues to work his way back. He's been around the Blue Jays clubhouse a lot in between these starts, getting his work in, palling around with guys. Nice to see him reintegrated into the team dynamic in the clubhouse. I went back and watched his last Buffalo start. The delivery stuff wasn't quite as noisy as his A-ball start, where apparently he was just all over the place delivery-wise, but he's not there yet. It'll be interesting to see how this one goes for him. Jays are off today, by the way. They'll play the Padres this weekend. That series is set up as Yariel Rodriguez against Matt Waldron on Friday. It's a 9:40 start in San Diego, so it'll be a late one. Jose Berríos against a TBD. That was supposed to be Yu Darvish's slot. He hit the IL yesterday. That's an 8:40 game. And then Chris Bassett against Joe Musgrove in the finale on Sunday at 4:10. Jays then go to Kansas City for four next week, including a nice afternoon, a Thursday afternoon game. So that's kind of your roundup of where last night went, where things sit right now. Again, apologies. We're not going to get Dan Shulman after all. I'm sure some of you have some thoughts on the bullpen management from last night. You can text those into 590-590. As always, we'll try to keep an eye on the text line throughout these shows. It'll probably be something we lean on a little bit more once we're back to 2 hours. But for now, the 1 hour slot, we'll take a look at those texts as well. Someone asked, by the way, sign and let us know your name and where you're from so we can shout you out. Someone who didn't sign theirs asked what the Jays need to start doing to hit for more power. It's a reasonable question. The Jays are 22nd in home runs early on here, 21st in runs. Stop me if you heard this last year. They're 11th in weighted runs created plus. So there's that gap again where the individual components are not adding up to runs the way you would expect. And part of that is because they're not hitting the long ball. Look, some of this is early season stuff. Some of this is I just don't know if they have the personnel to hit a lot of home runs. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. doesn't look like he's going to be a 45 home run guy again. Don Mattingly has talked about how he thinks it's maybe a team that could have a bunch of guys hit 20, but not anyone maybe be in those home run leaderboards. That's why something like Varsho showing a little bit more of the power he showed in Arizona is, even though it's a small window here and you don't want to lower the bar too far, adding that power element through the second half of your lineup could be really important for a team that doesn't figure to hit for a ton of power generally. Peter in High Park wonders if we'll look back at last night's loss as the worst loss of the season. Peter, buddy, I got news for you, man. We got 140 plus more of these things. They're going to get so much worse than that over the course of the next couple months. That one will hurt. That'll especially hurt if come September we're looking at division standings and looking at tiebreakers and things like that, and that one looks important. But a 4-2 loss that costs you, a 4-2 lead you blow that costs you a series sweep in the middle of a homestand where you're playing pretty well, they get way, way worse than that. We'll get there. As much as I don't want to promise that, I do promise that there will be worse losses than that one. Someone who didn't sign theirs, again, put your name and location on it so we can show you out and so we get to know you a little bit. That's one of the fun things by the end of the season. You get to learn texters and callers and things like that. On the call front, by the way, we can't take live calls. We're looking into maybe doing something like Blair and Barker do, where you get the back leg bits and things like that. But TBD on that. So keep the text coming to 590, 590 for the time being. So this person who didn't sign there said, why does everyone view Vladdy as a hitter who makes pitchers look silly? He isn't consistent enough outside of 2019. Look, I think the making pitchers look silly thing is long out the door. I haven't heard that much in recent time. I think why people maintain optimism that Vlad can be a better version of himself is that, well, he showed it over two-thirds of a season in 2021 where he was, you know, arguably the best hitter in baseball and didn't win an MVP because one of the other arguable best hitters in baseball was also a starting pitcher in Shohei Ohtani. Now, in terms of what to think of Vladimir Guerrero Jr. moving forward, you know, it's nice that the walk rate is back up. It's nice that the strikeout rate is still pretty low. I haven't loved the approach, to be honest. That, you know, there's some expanding of the zone, especially on the outer part of the plate. You know, he hasn't handled top end velocity particularly well. You know, maybe you don't care that much about the three home runs because he's been hitting the ball so hard. But again, most of his hard contact has come on the ground. So that's certainly something to monitor. Saw him doing a drill pregame the other day with a chunk of the plate blocked off for his tee work to try to make sure that swing is kind of left center field power alley to right center field power alley. That's what he's trying to do up there. But in terms of making the pitchers look silly to whoever asked that question, I don't think that's been a real conversation point since 2021, or shouldn't have been. This is a guy who right now has settled in as a good hitter, but not the terrific hitter that the Blue Jays need him to be. And to the earlier question, if the Blue Jays are going to be an average to above average power hitting team, the kind of guy they need Vladimir Guerrero Jr. To be. Last question before we take a break and talk to Ben Clemens from Fangraphs. Craig in Trenton asks a good one. How concerned should we be with Tim Mayza's start? And this is, again, if you had a healthy bullpen last night, I would have really not liked the Tim Mayza move. I texted our pal JD Bunkus when he came in of just, ooh, don't have a good feeling about this one, given the way Mayza's pitched. I know that Mayza has a track record here. There is probably room to give him space to work through some of the things here. He obviously had a tremendous year last year, one of the best relief pitching seasons in Blue Jays history by ERA, one of the best relief pitching seasons in all of baseball in terms of stranding runners that you inherited, which, hey, your starting pitchers are really going to love you. I know they made him do the bat boy thing for losing the Fantasy Football League, but I promise you the guy who strands the most runners in the league is very, very popular in the clubhouse. He's not off to a good start here. He's given up 7 earned runs over 6 2/3 an inning. He really hasn't been able to get swing and miss stuff. He's actually walked more batters than he's struck out. The velocity on his sinker is down almost 2 miles an hour. That's a pretty big deal. That's a pretty big deal, especially because you are a lefty who doesn't throw all that hard to begin with. So to drop from 93.5 to 91.5, 92 is a pretty big deal. You rely on that kind of 60-40 sinker slider split, sometimes even 70-30. You really need that sinker to be on. That's also, you know, the pitch that theoretically allows you to not be a loogie, not be a left-handed specialist. That's supposed to be the pitch that can help you get righties out. So the fact that that has lost some velocity, the fact that it has lost some movement, and the fact that guys are really putting a charge into it is concerning until we see a turnaround. Again, Mayza's got a track record here where, you know, don't want to be alarmist after a couple of bad appearances here, but it hasn't looked good so far. And last night kind of put a hard underline on that early start. We're going to take a break here. Apologies again for not getting Dan Shulman. We'll try to get him on the show in another spot sometime soon. We're going to take a break. We'll talk to Ben Clemens of Fangraphs. We'll do some Blue Jays stuff. I also want to go around at some of the early season Major League Baseball trends. Obviously, we're going to look at how those pertain to the Toronto Blue Jays, but it is an interesting point here about 20 games in to check in on things like, hey, is stolen base rate still up? What do we make of these pitcher injuries? Why is the league OPSing 702? It's killer because sometimes I'll reference a stat like OPS plus or weighted runs created plus that is trying to adjust what a player does to league average. But I don't know about you guys. My league average in my head is not a 700 OPS on base plus slugging. It's not a 240 batting average. My league average is calibrated a little higher. So some of these average lines feel pretty light. We'll talk to Ben Clemens about all of that. We'll also check in on Jordan Hicks, who's looked pretty good as a starter so far. Ben Clemens of Fangraphs joins us next on the first official Jays Talk Plus back on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Ailish Forafar.
And I'm Justin Cuthbert.
Join us as we discuss the most important sports stories of the day and tee up the biggest games of the night.
It's The Fan Pregame, 6 p.m. weekdays on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Blake Murphy. We're back for the season, as I mentioned off the top, 11 to 12 p.m. for now, 10 to 12 eventually. But hopefully that's not for a long time, because that would mean your Toronto Maple Leafs went on a nice playoff run. Your Toronto Raptors did not. So the Raptors show wrapped up for the year. If you want more information on what's next for Will Liu and Alex Wong, by the way, they put out a banter pod this morning. They didn't give away too much, but you can go check them out. Wishing them all the best, obviously, my co-hosts from the Raptor show this season. Joining me now is one of my Jays Talk Plus regulars, one of my favorite people to talk to in all of baseball. It's Ben Clemens of Fangraphs. Ben, I got to ask you off the top, man. I'm watching the Baltimore Orioles game the other day, and I got to wonder, I'm not on TV a lot, but I see Kevin Brown holding a puppy as part of Dogs at the Park night, and he gets to do like the broadcast intro like that. Why aren't we doing that in all 30 parks, all 162 games?
I agree. I mean, maybe everyone's just not as good as Kevin Brown at calling a game while holding a dog. That seems kind of hard. But yeah, it was great.
Yeah, but a lot of people aren't as good at Kevin Brown at a lot of things. Doing a Tom DeLonge Blink-182 impression, calling baseball games, all sorts of things. Ben, not many people are as good at you as at writing about baseball. As bad as I am at tripping over that sentence, a little offended that the Blue Jays have not made your weekly five things you did or did not like in baseball lists just yet. I know it's early in the season, but the Blue Jays here, they've played 19 games now. They just had a nice little homestand, blown game yesterday aside. What are you liking or not liking about the Toronto Blue Jays here?
I mean, I guess first I should just say that one thing that I'm liking is that I was wrong about Dalton Varsho. I feel like we talked about him often enough last year, and I'm just like not, I was just not a believer. And I was wrong. I don't really know what other way to say it than that. Like, I don't know that he's going to keep this start up, but I thought he was just kind of unplayable as a hitter. Like, just didn't hit enough to make it work. And look, he's not going to keep getting it done with this much power. That's just not what his game is. But he has these little streaks in him. And I didn't think he could do it without kind of losing the strike zone. Like, if you told me that he'd be hitting for this much power, 60 plate appearances in, it looks like, I'd say, yeah, well, he's probably swinging out of his shoes. But he's been pretty measured. And, you know, he's playing his normal great defense. So that's been, like, a nice, pleasant surprise. I think I'd add in, like, Yusei Kikuchi as well as a thing I've liked so far.
Yes, absolutely love Kikuchi's start here. I'm with you on Varsho as well, and I kind of joked off the top of the show that, hey, just pull the ball in the air. It'll work out more often, and obviously those have been his right. home runs. His pull rate is actually down a little bit, so I'm fascinated to dig into that a little bit more and maybe talk to him about what approach changes there are there, if any. But yeah, so far, so good on the Varsho front. You mentioned how good his defense is as well, and I wonder where Kevin Kiermaier's start ranks for you in terms of points of concern. And I mentioned Kiermaier just because I know in your chat at Fangraphs, I think your most recent one, it was basically like a just running chat of, is this guy cooked? Is this guy cooked?
Yeah.
Is this guy cooked? And it's like, well, a lot of guys, when they're into their mid-30s, you know, once the fall-off happens, the fall-off happens. Now, Kiermaier's coming off of a very good year last year, one where he was better than expectations and better than he had been in years. You know, George Springer's off to just kind of an average start at the plate here. Just more generally, but I guess specific to Kiermaier and Springer, what warning signs are you looking for when guys do start to decline in their mid-30s?
So, yeah, let's start with Kiermaier. I'm pulling up his numbers here. I'd say the big thing that scares me about Kiermaier and makes me kind of lean toward, yeah, maybe he's cooked, is he is just not hitting the ball hard. And that isn't something that you can really fake so much. Like, yeah, he's striking out more and that is ugly, but I'm willing to accept that that takes a while to stabilize and maybe he's gotten a little unlucky or like he's just faced particularly nasty pitchers. But he's like not making as much contact in the zone and he's not hitting the ball hard when he does. And that's basically baseball, right? Like the whole point of hitting is to find pitches to hit and then hit them. And he's failing at both sides. Like he's missing too often and not hitting the ball hard. That is just scary. Like I think that that's a thing that you could really see decline with age. And that worries me. Like Kiermaier's game has never been about hitting the ball super hard, obviously. But he's hitting the ball at like David Fletcher, Luis Arraez levels of authority right now. Like guys who make a living by controlling the strike zone with incredible precision and never missing when they swing. And that's never been his game. You know, he's not like a like super low strikeout rate guy. That's just not how he's succeeded. He's succeeded because he's a great defender who like does enough on offense. And if he's not like getting his 10 homers and not walking too much and hitting for a good BABIP and like hitting a bunch of doubles because of his speed, the offense is just not going to work. So I'm quite worried about that. I think he's not going to keep hitting this bad and he's still playing good defense, it looks like to me. So I'm not worried that he's going to be like unplayable, but it might be more of a 20% below league average bat kind of deal than we're used to with Kiermaier. And look, he's defied time for a long time, continuing to be an average hitter. So you knew it was coming eventually. It's kind of sad that it's happening because, I don't know, he's so fun. Like, I'd like for him to play forever.
So would I. I would love to watch that defense in center field for years and years. But the nice thing the Jays do have is Varsho can slide over there if Kiermaier's bat is such that, hey, going to take the defensive trade-off in left field sometimes and get Davis Schneider in there a little more often or something like that. Jays have some flexibility, some options there. Ben, want to zoom outside the Blue Jays here to some general kind of major league trends early on. And I mentioned this before the break, and it kind of drives me nuts because when we talk about 20% below league average or whatever, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm calibrated for like in my head, like, oh yeah, like a 735, 740 OPS. That feels league average. Yeah. And right now it's 702. I don't know what to make of that. Obviously, I think this is related to, you know, some of the conversations we had about pitcher injuries and velo being up and how hyper-specialized everyone is. But at a high level, what do you make of offense being even lower to start this season?
Yeah. It's not feeling great. I mean, if you kind of look through the numbers, a lot of this has to do with power. Like, on base hasn't changed that much. People are getting on base, I mean, not very frequently, which is what they've been doing for a while. That's kind of the way the game has gone. And the thing that's changed a lot is that people are just not slugging. And that has dragged down OPS. Like, I'm just looking at 2022, 2023, and 2024. So slugging percentage is 10 points lower than it was in 2022. And we kind of know that after that year, it feels like something gave. They tried to change stolen base rules to change up the game. They tried to speed up pitchers. It seems like the ball got a little more lively last year. And all of that has just vanished. Now, could that just be the weather? You know, we're starting in like the early part of the season, obviously. And that is just, it's colder, so the ball doesn't travel as far. Yeah, I haven't looked into it enough to say how much of it is due to weather. And the fact that it mostly looks like power is, I suppose, encouraging that it could come back as things warm up. But I don't think that's all of it. I don't think that that's all of it at all. Meredith Wills, the astrophysicist who dissects baseballs to look at their carry, has said that it looks like some early evidence is that the ball is just traveling less far. And that's not from dissecting baseballs. That's from looking at kind of the I don't know what the right word for this is, like the aerodynamic equations of how far the ball has traveled against predicted. And so she's in the process of trying to rip some up and figure out what's going on. That's where I'd look first. But also, I just kind of hope it comes back. Like, it's too early to say for certain. There are fluctuations like this throughout the season. But it looks like the real thing that's happening is that balls just aren't carrying. And you got to hope that that changes as the weather heats up. Doesn't really look like that much that pitchers are doing has changed. Like, strikeout rate is pretty much the same. Walk rate's actually a little higher this year. But if the ball's not leaving the yard, offense is going to look like this.
Which is tough. And maybe I'll have to have Meredith on and we'll live dissect a ball on air or something like that now that we've got the TV component as well. So one of the things that you can do when the home run environment decreases, and this is usually more at the team level. If you're not a team that hits a lot of bombs, you got to play a little bit more small ball. That means maybe stealing bases a little bit more. League-wide, last year we saw this was more in response to rule changes, but stolen base rates and stolen base success rate increased. This year, if you told me, hey, the overall offensive environment in baseball is going to be less homer friendly, the logical thing for teams to do would be to push that base running even more. Now, equilibriums like that aren't efficient. Teams aren't going to be able to adjust immediately to new information like that. However, what we've seen in the early going, and I know you wrote about this at Fangraphs the other week, and since that time, it's normalized a little bit. But last year, we left the season saying stolen base rate was way up. Stolen base success rate was way up. In fact, the numbers would suggest teams should be even more aggressive on the bases. We haven't seen that yet. It's normalized almost to last year's levels, but it's still down a little bit. What do you make of that? I would have thought we, especially in the early on here, we would have seen teams pushing it a little bit more.
Yeah. I've been thinking about this one a lot. I have a kind of an idea in my head for something further to do on this with, like, how aggressive should you be if you had perfect information? I haven't quite gotten through that yet, so I can't tell you the conclusions. But the first thing that springs to mind when I'm looking at this is, like, maybe teams looked at last year and said, yeah, this is good. Like some of the steals after this that we're picking up are just not that valuable to us. Like, if we're stealing at a 79% clip and getting, like, call it one a game, I don't have the numbers in front of me. Like, let's just leave it there. Like, we don't need to steal 1.2 a game at a 75% clip. And, like, that's actually not how teams talk in real life, right? Like, they're not, That's I guarantee you that's not what's going on in the hitter meeting. But whoever's looking at the data for the team is translating that into like, you guys are doing good. Like, you don't need to push more edges. Like, this looks okay. I think that just speaks to like teams being happy with something working well and not feeling like they need to change it. That's something that, you know, we don't talk about in terms of sports analysis. We look at a lot of things and say like, oh, well, it's not perfect yet, so they should keep pressing in service of perfection. But that's not how the world works, right? You don't like tweak these dials and like, oh, well, we could add like 1% of stolen bases. Often if something's working well, you give these like big, broad changes. Like if you're a base runner and you think, I'm not aggressive enough, let's do more things where I'm not sure I'm going to make it. That can go too far. Like that could easily go too far. And like, I think what the evidence is telling you is teams were happy with their frequency and success rate last year. They're not feeling the need to make these big kind of like large level changes, go way more, like go on first move with no pickoff throws more often. They're more confident with saying, like, we liked what we were doing last year. It added value. Let's just keep adding value the same way. And like, that doesn't seem wrong to me. If anything, I think it makes a lot of sense that as pitchers and catchers get more adjusted to these rules, like they have counterplay too. I mean, luckily, I don't think I was on the record as predicting another big stolen base increase this year, because I make a lot of dumb predictions. I think I just happened to miss that one. But I think what you're seeing is that teams are just happy here and they are waiting to see what pitchers and catchers can do to adjust to this. I will note that, man, catchers are getting pretty good. Like, pop time is down across the league. That's how long it takes from the time the ball hits your glove to the time it hits a second baseman's glove. Like, that has decreased a little bit again this year. Pitcher moves look like they're a little bit better, and time to the plate looks a little bit better. Teams are just playing their better throwing catchers more often. And that kind of makes sense. Like, if you're in the minors 2 years ago, they might be like, no one steals. Like, don't worry about it. And now it's like, well, people are going to try to steal on you. Like, I don't know if you saw last year, but everyone's stealing. Like, spend more time working on your throwing. I'm guessing that it's going to take years and years for this to get to like a true equilibrium. But the more I think about it, the more it's like, well, after the first move was like more steals and more success rate, maybe everything will just consolidate here for a while and we'll see which way it goes.
And I think that makes sense at the team level, at the player level. If you're the first base coach, et cetera, do you want to be the team that runs into a bunch of outs to determine, well, right, this was the point at which we should have stopped running, right? You don't want to be, you've gotten it, what in your eyes are probably a few free extra steals. Why push it if that's not your game, or you feel comfortable with the aggression level you have? So that's a great point, Ben. I have one last theory on why offense is down in baseball, and I'll run it by you. The Chicago White Sox have been hitting Kevin Pillar fourth and Paul DeJong sixth sometimes. I have seen more White Sox baseball early on than I would care to. The Jays are going to see the Royals next week, who are off to a really good start, but they've played the White Sox seven times. So I don't know if I should buy in on Brady Singer, or he just keeps pitching against the White Sox over and over again. A quick take on the Royals.
Yeah, I'm going to make it a quick take on the White Sox first.
Perfect.
Before the season, we're like messing around with new ways of trying to figure out what injuries could do to teams. And bad teams always look less affected by injuries in our numbers because they don't have any good players to replace. the better you are, the more it hurts when your stars are out and you have to play minor leaguers instead. Like, that just makes sense. So all the bad teams don't get that much worse if their best players get hurt. Except the White Sox, who don't even have replacement level minor leaguers. Like, their minor leaguers are just so bad that our model was like, oh God, if these guys get hurt, like, it's going to be awful. And they were already awful. Like, they were the 28th best team before any injuries. And then they still get way worse. It was shocking. Like, I've never seen a team constructed like that before. And wouldn't you know it, everybody's hurt. it's just a train wreck. That is the worst team in baseball by a mile. And some of it is their construction. Some of it is the fact that two of their better hitters, I mean, Luis Robert is just great. Yoan Moncada, I don't think he'd play on the Blue Jays, but he's still one of their best hitters. Like, it's a real problem. And he's hurt. And they have no replacement. They're playing like a Nicky Lopez, Lenin Sosa, Paul DeJong infield. It's ugly.
It's not good, man.
Really
we saw the Paul DeJong thing briefly last year. It didn't work out too well. This did work out well. Ben Clemens of Fangraphs, thanks for taking the time, man. I will be bugging you plenty now that we're back.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Blake.
Ben Clemens of Fangraphs, thanks to him for coming on. Thanks to him for being flexible timing-wise. We have Dan Schulman on the line now joining us. Dan Schulman, of course, the voice of the Toronto Blue Jays on Sportsnet. Dan, how you doing, man?
I messed up your whole show, didn't I?
That's okay. This is live radio, baby. This is what we got to do. I got to just unload my takes on bullpen management and how to manage a bullpen that's down three or four guys, you know?
Gotcha. And what was your take on yesterday?
That your leverage arms got to pitch better in leverage if they're available to you for the most part. How did you feel about it? Obviously, we didn't find out until afterwards, but Romano, Garcia, and Chad Green were all unavailable, which explains the kind of Swanson Mesa ninth.
Right. So, I mean, we had talked about it. You could kind of guess going into the game that Romano and Garcia were not available. We didn't know anything about Chad Green. So Richards does the sixth, and then Cabrera does the seventh and the eighth, and Swanson's up. But we started wondering about Green, and when Swanson gives up the home run, and I guess Bowden Francis got up at that point, that's when you knew Chad Green was not available. So they were really limited. So the only, you know, what were the choices? The choices were Swanson to Mesa, and then you could have taken Mesa out to put Francis in, or you could have left Swanson in longer, which didn't seem like a good idea. He wasn't having a great outing, and I can't remember exactly who was up, but there, you know, there was a left-handed bat coming up. So Mesa comes in, that makes sense. And then, the only thing that could have been done was you could have brought in Bowden Francis for Aaron Judge. Those were the only two options. You leave Mesa or you bring in Francis, at least that I was considering in the moment. I don't know if you know, after the fact or this morning talked about other things, but when you're down three relievers, it's a problem. And I wish, you know, the unwritten rules were a little bit more lenient. Like, I wish Jimmy Garcia could have come in to get two batters, or I get the Romano thing, but I wish they would have brought Jimmy in. But teams don't use relievers 3 days in a row, especially early in the season. So I think they were very limited, and unfortunately it didn't work out.
Last question on that, because I think that all makes sense. That's all pretty straightforward. The Mesa over Bowden move, some of it to do with, you know, Soto was going to be the third batter up if it got to that. Was that to you more about the fact that Yariel Rodriguez starts tomorrow and you want the long man in the bullpen fresh, especially after you just used Yenesis Cabrera for a couple innings?
I think that's part of it, to be honest with you. I did not look at John Schneider's postgame comments. I have like a whole day of nothing today, so I can do that today. So I don't know exactly what he said about that, but that's an issue too. They are going with a starting pitcher who is maybe a 4 to 5 inning guy at this point. And, I mean, we talked about it during the game, I think earlier in the game, one of the reasons why Bowden Francis survived the cut that Mitch White and Nate Pearson did not is that they need a quote unquote, a long man or a multi-inning guy, given that he's going to be piggybacking with Yariel Rodriguez. I mean, the really interesting thing, and maybe interesting is the wrong word, would have been if the game had gone extra innings. Like, say Mesa gets Judge and it goes extra innings, like Bowden Francis is in. You don't have a choice. And then there's probably a roster move of some sort for today, however they would have figured that out for tomorrow. However they would have figured that out, I have no idea. But, yeah, when you're down three relievers and another guy is kind of being held back for the Rodriguez starts, you're kind of down four relievers. They just didn't have many options. It all would have worked out great if they, you know, if you can't bring in, that's an Eric Swanson spot, right? I know it's his first outing of the season, but Swanson was great last year. You can bring him in the ninth inning with a 2-run lead. And sometimes it just doesn't work out. And yesterday was one of those games.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And that was basically my take as well. Your leverage guy's got to pitch better in leverage if they're available, even if you would have preferred, Swanson's first appearance back be in a lower leverage spot. So some other positives in this one. And one thing I wanted to pick your brain about, just because you and I were talking about it on the field before Tuesday's game, we saw Kevin Biggio taking reps at third base, and you pointed out, I don't think I've seen him do that yet. Then he came into the game yesterday and started at third base. We can't take all of that for gospel because we also saw Alejandro Kirk taking a bunch of reps at first base that I don't think we'll see. But this is more like an inside baseball journalism job. But how much do you take from that time on the field and what we're seeing in those pregame windows?
It is kind of selective. So, yes, I have seen, as have you, Alejandro Kirk taking ground balls at first. I've now seen it, I think, three different times. So the first two times I kind of swatted it away. I'm going to ask a question about it tomorrow, but who knows? But the Biggio one at third, to me, Cavan's a different kind of guy. When you see Cavan doing something that he doesn't normally do, you notice it a little bit more if I'm having a good day, which I guess I was on Tuesday. So, it kind of clicked in. I was driving home Tuesday night and I said, Stroman's pitching tomorrow. That's a matchup they like David Schneider on. And so if Varsho and Kiermaier are both going to be in the outfield, because one of them sat on Tuesday? Kiermaier sat on Tuesday, I think. One of them sat on Tuesday. But now a righty back in Stroman, they want Varsho and Kiermaier both in there. If they want Schneider in there, where can Cavan play? He can go to third base. No Clement, no IKF. And again, I think it's just another way they can rotate guys around. They're kind of six guys for four spots every single day. And Biggio is great. And I actually talked about it with him on Wednesday before the game when he jogged onto the field. I said, hey, when did you know? And he actually said, not till after the game Tuesday. He said, but they'll sometimes give me a heads up and say, hey, why don't you do this if you have time before the game, without explicitly saying, because you're playing there on this day or something like that. And he is so good. And we talked about it in the office Wednesday with John Schneider. He is so good at doing it on his own. But if they want to give him a little heads up that he's doing something out of the ordinary, they will let him know. And there are some days where he'll take balls at third and in right, or at first and at second, whatever the case may be. So, there's only so many things they can do in secret behind closed doors. Sometimes you got to take ground balls on the field, and Biggio's a good guy to keep an eye on in that respect.
Certainly, and good. Hey, the lineup juggling and things like that, good thing you kept Dalton Varsho's bat in the lineup yesterday. Two home runs, four on the homestand. Dan, I've only got you for about 2.5 minutes more, but the Varsho side of things, obviously, when you're playing better, things are going to be lighter, it's going to be easier. But do you put any stock into the fact that, you know, maybe last year there was a little bit of pressure on him, self-imposed, given that he came over in trade, given that, you know, he was the new guy and things like that, that maybe there's a little bit, like, I know he's just like such a well-liked clubhouse guy and things like that. It seemed to me in a small window, he's a little looser this year.
Absolutely. Like 200%. And I'll be quick on this, but he was brought over and they didn't say this to him when he walked into the room, but, you know, help balance the lineup, hit cleanup, helped lead a team that had World Series aspirations, protect Vladdy, and he's a tinkerer and a perfectionist. That's a lot. And it was a tough year for him. I think he's in a much better place. I've talked to him about it a lot. I also think he hit the pitches he's supposed to hit. Take away the one from the lefty, but the one that Stroman threw was a two-seamer down right where he likes it. The grand slam was a fastball, kind of, it was middle of the plate and you know, thigh high. It wasn't up at the belt. It wasn't above that. Those were the pitches he's supposed to hit, and he's not missing them. He's not popping them up. He's talked a lot about swing path and mechanical adjustment. So I think it's a lot of things. I think it's better swing decisions, better swing path, and yes, yes, yes to everything that you said.
San Diego and Kansas City up next on the schedule. Those got to rank pretty high in terms of favorite ballparks for you, Dan?
Yes, I would say San Diego is top five. I haven't been here in several years. I cannot wait to go see it. And Kansas City has withstood the test of time beautifully. It is great on a nice night with the waterfalls and all that. We're here a little bit earlier in the season than normally. I think the Blue Jays come here, but they're both great, especially San Diego. And I'm going to do, just because I've got time today, I don't think many of the Blue Jays have played here. So it'll be interesting, I'm sure, for them. And I'll take their pulse tomorrow when I see them at the ballpark. But yeah, if you are a go visit ballparks kind of person and San Diego is within your means, there are many, many reasons to come to San Diego, and the ballpark is beautiful. It's definitely one of them.
Well, I hope you have a good trip. Listen, looking forward to you and Buck on the calls. Dan Schulman, thanks so much, man.
All right, Blake, thanks.
Dan Schulman, voice of the Toronto Blue Jays on Sportsnet. I have not been to San Diego. I have been to Kansas City. San Diego, one of the seven left that I haven't been to. I will not make it this weekend. I don't think I can get there in time after my show tomorrow. If I left yesterday, I would have made it in time. This has been the return of Jays Talk Plus. A little rusty, obviously. We'll be back in this same slot tomorrow. Blair and Barker have more Jays for you at 2 p.m. The Jeff Merrick Show is next. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of good NHL playoff content. Thanks to Amit Mann, Lance Kennedy, Jennifer Rolnick. We will talk to you at 11 a.m. tomorrow.